This is Circe Olson Wessner. I'm the director of the Museum of the American Military Family in Tejeros, New Mexico, and this is our podcast, Colorblind. I'm speaking with Art Harris. He's an Air Force brat and an Air Force veteran, and he's the operations officer for our museum, the Museum of the American Military Family. Hi, Art.
Hi, how you doing, Circe?
I'm doing great. So Art and I have worked together. We see each other, but since this pandemic has started, we're doing everything by phone, social distancing. So I just wanted to thank you for joining me here today. And I just wanted to kind of start off our conversation today about your growing up years. Where all were you stationed as a kid?
Well, I was born into the military. My father was stationed in Little Rock, Arkansas. I was born in Phoenix, Arizona. But as far as I remember, since first grade, I was in Little Rock, Arkansas, all the way up until second grade. Then I went to Illinois, Scott Air Force Base, right outside St. Louis. And I think I was there until the fourth grade. And then we moved to Arizona. Arizona all the way up to the seventh grade. Then we moved to Belgium. There was a remote nuclear missile base out there owned by the Belgians. We owned the nukes. So it was half and half of joint base. So my father worked, my stepfather worked with the ground launch cruise missiles. So he was in charge of protecting the cruise missiles. So we stationed out there, I think, for a couple of years, all the way until ninth grade. Part of my freshman year, I went to NATO headquarters, which was SHAPE, which is called SHAPE High School. I did that for most of my ninth grade, and then we moved to England, Woodbridge American High School, which was hosting Bentwaters military base, and I was there until I graduated. After graduating from high school, then I went to Germany, where they had a University of Maryland in right outside Munich, Germany. The campus used to be on Munich, but then they moved to a town about maybe an hour outside of Munich called Augsburg, Germany, and that's where I started going to University of Maryland there at. So yeah, pretty extensive history there being a military.
Well, listen, listening to you reel off all the places you live, you sound almost like an Army kid. They moved a lot.
Yeah, definitely. Look, Air Force, Army, we all moved everywhere. It was, to Navy brats and stuff like that, Marine brats, they all have the same story. We all moved everywhere 20 million different times.
Well, like I ask everyone, I'm going to ask you this. Which was your favorite base, and did you have a least favorite one?
Let's see. I'm not sure if I have a least favorite one. I think my most favorite was, it would have to be Belgium. When I went to high school at the NATO headquarters, our bus ride was an hour and a half there from rural Belgium. We were about 15 minutes from the French border. And it was every day I got to see beautiful sights of the Meuse River, and we went through Brussels and Bruges. We went to all kind of beautiful cities, and I got to see that every day. So what I remember is the traveling. The high school trip was an hour and a half. I remember the traveling. I remember Belgium being so beautiful. What I say, my least favorite place, I think, probably Little Rock, Arkansas. I was young, and I remember going through a Catholic school there, and in Little Rock before I left to go to Scott Air Force Base. And I remember getting spanked at the school because I was talking to a kid. We were supposed to go take a nap. We weren't supposed to talk. But because I told a kid to go to sleep or we'll get in trouble, they caught me talking, and I remember getting whipped with a belt. And this is in Little Rock, Arkansas. So that was my least favorite place.
Well, yeah, and you were actually absolutely true. You were going to get in trouble if you talked, and you sure did.
And I sure did. I got in trouble for it. So, yeah, that's my big memory from Little Rock. So, yeah, not very happy memories.
Yeah, well, I'm sure it's improved somewhat. So, listen, growing up in the 80s and 90s, and then you served in the Air Force in the 2000s, you experienced some big historic events, like the fall of the wall in Germany and Chernobyl, the nuclear disaster, and 9/11. Do you have any memories about any of those things, some strong memories? And what other historic happenings come to mind for you?
Absolutely. When I probably one of the earliest memories, I think I was in 10th grade when the Lockerbie disaster went. That's when President Gaddafi of Libya blew up one of the Pan Am American airliners off the coast of England. That was, I remember in our school, that was huge news. And then not too long later, from Lakenheath, it was a military base about 2.5 hours from us. They led the strike mission with the F-111s to go bomb, Libya. And I remember that was the talk of the town for the longest. It's just about from the Lockerbie, because I remember it impacted so many people. The plane went down and killed like 7 people on the ground and one in a local village near the edge of England. And of course, so many people were lost on the airplane.
Right.
And back then, during this time, like hijackings were the norm from the late 80s to the 90s. And, of course, this is something, finally, we did something about it and started bombing the people that were, that were part of it. Lockerbie, and then, during the Berlin Wall, we were out there playing a football game, and we were there right when the wall started falling and people were coming across. I remember we were afraid because we thought that the East German guards were going to start shooting people, and they were going to start closing up the border for us to go back to England. And once it was told that the border guards had left their post and it was safe to go there to the Berlin Wall area, we traveled up there. And I remember seeing so many people hugging, so many people coming across the river from East Germany, and they were crying. Families they had seen each other in decades, crying and hugging each other. And people were singing, and people had pickaxes, and they were knocking down the wall. And we picked up the piece and took it back to our... To our school, but it was bittersweet because we got our butts whooped at that football game. We brought our band, we brought our cheerleaders, we brought our dance team, only to get beat. We got this not beat out of us, but still, in the end, we didn't realize that it was a part of history being done. It was like, wow, the Berlin Wall's down. I remember all of us kids were thinking, like, what does this mean? Because in the 80s and 90s. It was the fear of the Russian military coming over and taking over Europe. That's all we thought of. That's all our lives revolved around of. Even as part of our curriculum, even part of everyday TV in front of us, was about the evil Russian military coming across and killing us all or making the world not free.
Right.
So it was quite an impact when that wall came down because it was we were unsure what this meant from then on.
Right.
Are they over? Is the Russian military done? Or, we used to do nuclear missile drills in our school, and all of a sudden it's like, does this mean this is over as a kid? So.
Wow. Yeah, my husband was stationed on the border further up in the Fulda Gap on the night that...
Yes, we all were close to everything.
We were, but I think it might have been more fun to have been in Berlin. I'm just going to go off topic here now that you made me think about Berlin. How did you get from England to Berlin to play football? Did you fly or did you take the train or tunnel or what?
No, what we ended up doing the ferries across the channel. So since our base was literally 15 minutes from Felixstowe. Felixstowe is like a ferry station that takes you back and forth to Europe. So we loaded everybody up on a ferry. The ferry took about, I think we got there in the evening. It took pretty much overnight once we got to Calais, France. When we got to Calais, France, we took a chartered bus that took us all the way to East Berlin. Once we got to East Berlin, we had to go through 4 or 5 different Russian checkpoints.
Wow.
Until we got to Berlin. And then once we got to Berlin, it was literally like night because East Germany was rural. You couldn't see nobody. We didn't go through no cities or anything. And then once we got to Berlin, it was this huge, bustling city. And to get on the bus, all you had to do was show your ID card. It was literally night day. It was a different world. So yeah, we used the ferry channel because the channel was still being built at the time. The the car that burrowed under the car tunnel that burrowed under the city, it was just starting to be built. So it was just the ferry back and forth from England to Belgium.
Wow. So was that just a regular game or was that a championship game? That seems like an awful lot of...
It was a championship game.
Okay, yeah,
so,
I was going to say, that seemed awful.
Number one in England, and then there were two, there was Germany South and Germany North. Augsburg was the champ in the south of Germany, and Berlin was champ of North in Germany. Mm-hmm. So the fight was between... England and Germany North to play, and then whoever the winner was at would play Germany South. So I think in the end, we end up losing, and then Germany North won. Berlin won, so we can say, look, we lost to the champions.
Yeah,
well, that made us feel better that we lost to the champions.
Well, yeah. Well, and it's only fair that their history was being made and they were the team that was in the history being made. So, yeah. Okay, you can't hate them too much. So, another thought, you know, everybody talks about how wonderful their experience was going to DoD schools. And a topic on everybody's mind right now, of course, is race. Did you experience racism either as a kid or as a service member? Anything?
Well, this is where I'm gonna start as a kid. Mm-hmm. When I was born into the military, we was always in different places where when I first started, my biological father, he was also in the Air Force. And between my mother and my stepfather, who was also in the Air Force, we lived in poor neighborhoods. My mother was just barely scraped by, and usually all black neighborhoods. And when she met my stepfather, we ended up moving on base, and it was pretty diverse. Mm-hmm. It was less black folks than white, but it was diverse. It was just getting used to. Getting used to another group of people again.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But once I went to Europe, it was literally a culture shock. It was a culture shock because the junior high we went to, we were the only black children there. And everybody made a note of it. You know, everybody, they were nice. I think they were more curious than anything. And of course, we were curious back and we didn't know what to think. As my sister, she's 2 years younger than me. I think at the time I was 13, 14, and I think she was 10 or 9.
Mm.
And she was, you know, we were both trying to figure out how this works, and we were both very alienated. And most kids, you know, they were all white at this rural base in Belgium.
Mm-hmm.
They were all mainly white, and they seemed to always make it a note that we were black. And you know, the kids wanted to find me a girlfriend. There was one black girl that lived there, and she wanted to. So at one point, they didn't mean it, but I think I was always reminded that I was different.
Mm.
I didn't take much note of it, but I always felt self-conscious about it. I started being self-conscious of my skin color because everybody made it a note. Not only that, I grew up a little, you know, I developed a little bit different. I had a full-grown beard in 7th and 8th grade, and most kids didn't. So that made me stand out even more. As I went through junior high, the rest of junior high and high school, it was like in America where most of the school was 14% black, mostly 70% white. And it really reflected what's going on in America. And we stuck together as far as black folks. The other black kids, we kind of stuck together and kind of called it a solidarity. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, we knew that, you know, our fathers were fighting for the same thing. And there was, for us, there was no such thing as, there was no racism. What we saw in the news with the Rodney King stuff, that affected us a lot because we had no idea that was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, once we saw the videos and the police beating Rodney King down, we was like, does that really go on? We were all asking that. And what does that really mean for us? And we're trying to figure out, where do we fit in this world? Mm-hmm. But nobody really talked about it. You go to history, you know, in our history classes, slavery was mentioned very little.
Mm-hmm.
Christopher Columbus was celebrated.
Yeah.
Not a lot of, and Dodd Schools was a great, man, I had some of the best education that I have anywhere else. But when it comes to history, a lot of that was kind of blanked out from what I remember. And as black kids, we just kind of, as solidarity, we did our best to get along and just try to belong, because we were all trying to figure out what black looked like. What does another race, how do we get along? How do we mimic? You know, we looked at TV programs like rap, you know, like rap shows, and we looked at MTV was just getting big, and we saw the videos, and that influenced what we wear. We looked at other black performers because we didn't know, we were disconnected from that. So what did they wear? You know, the internet wasn't around, so that's
right,
how we connected with everything, how we figured out how we fit in.
So you're talking about when you were living overseas, you know, because you were in Belgium and then England for, you know, most of your childhood.
Yes, I'm thinking that's what I'm talking about, is junior high and high school,
right,
all the way through.
All right, the world. You were looking.
Right. So yeah, and I'm bringing up to the military. I'm bringing up to when I was in the military.
Okay.
So do we have enough time?
Oh yeah, sure.
Okay. So college was pretty much the same. I think there was only one professor, one black professor there, and he didn't like me too much. I don't know why. I hung out with a certain fraternity, and I think he looked at me a certain way. And I remember looking at him like, oh, brothers, 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 we brothers. But no, he did not like me just because of the company I kept. So, you know, at some point when you're over there in Europe and you're around mostly, you know, white people, you kind of feel alone. And you're just trying your best to belong.
Mm.
And I think at some point, I never felt that I was being discriminated upon, but I kind of felt alone. I kind of felt like the few of us that were together, we kind of band together and tried to figure it out, but we didn't know ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
So I joined the military out of Europe. And I think that's when I came to America, is when I really started seeing differences between races, from white to black.
Mm-hmm.
I started seeing, because I grew up different, I saw from my own fellow African-Americans, is that I talk different, you know, I move different, I acted different, and therefore I didn't belong to them.
Mm-hmm.
Or it was always brought up that, you know, I was different from them. And then when I, from my white brethren, who I thought were brethren, you know, it was clear that I did not belong with them either. And I was like, well, those are isolated incidents. I tried to belong. You know, started deploying to Afghanistan and Iraq, Operation Southern Watch in Kuwait. You know, we all got along. It's like, look, we're all one big brotherhood. We all joined this military. We're all one fighting unit. And it wasn't until in the military, I think, when I went to Afghanistan, you know, my first stint in Iraq in 2006, is when I saw true racism, where it was a complaint about too many blacks in leadership. And I think what the command did was put white leadership along with the black leadership, so it didn't look so lopsided to people who complained. And I remember that's when I really realized that there is an institution going on, whether people know it or not. There's an institution going on where, you know, there's a status quo, and race does matter where you're at. And as I think back after I retire, I remember I was being deployed a lot more unnecessarily than most other people. And I got the disability to prove it.
Uh-huh.
But in the end, it's still, you know, as I'm out of the military, I'm still learning this as I go. I'm very sensitive about it because as I grew up as a military brat, I believed that we were all one people. And it wasn't until I came back to America, from my Department of Defense schools, and I realized that that wasn't true. There was a status quo. There was a institutional racism that's still out there, clean and free.
Mm-hmm.
So it was very frustrating. It was very frustrating for me to do my job. And, you know, I made it to 20 years, but I should have made it longer. But I was so disenfranchised and
disappointed.
Upset about what was going on. So, yeah, that was my experience from, you know, that is my experience from being a military brat all the way up to now, that it's very much out there.
Well, so as the operations officer of our museum, how do you think we as a museum or we as an institution can address issues such as racism or any other sensitive topic that may be difficult or hard to present or hard to talk about?
Well, I don't believe it's hard to present, but I believe we should have a section up on race in the military.
Mm-hmm.
I believe the military for enlisted for blacks, I think, is around, 16-18% as enlisted, and I think maybe only 9% as the officers. I think we need to have a section on just of color, not just black, but just of color. Of what it's like in the military, because it is a different world. You know, most people that you're going to be around, your bosses are going to be of white origin. People around you are going to be of white origin. How does life change? And life changes for all of us that are of color once we come in that situation, because you have to learn quickly to conform and to act accordingly and act correctly so you don't, you know, so you don't stand out. So you don't stand out. I believe as an operations officer of the American Military Museum, we should set up a section for people of color, people in their struggles or their thought process or their journey through a military in a country that is predominantly white. And what did that look like to them? I think that would shed a lot of light on everybody, not just people of color, but even just white people, like, oh, I didn't know. I thought military is all the same as I thought I did.
Mm-hmm.
And in the end, it's not the same, especially if your eyes are open to certain things.
That's a good idea. I mean, that is really a good idea. I hadn't thought about something specifically like that. I've been thinking, you know, putting everybody together, you know, like if you have a quote from someone who's African American in an exhibit, but maybe it is a good idea to make a separate exhibit. That's something to think
about. I agree. It's a good idea that we got the LGBTQT going on, and it's a lot of great stories in there, but you'd be surprised that there's a section of people of color. You will see the similar struggles that, you know, they had to go through that we also had to go through, as far as conforming to what is around us, standing out as an individual. How do we fit in and not become so much individuals that we end up alienating everybody else around us?
Okay. All right. Well, fair enough. That's probably our next exhibit then.
Sounds good.
Okay. Hey, switching gears again. Did you have any other ideas, or was that...
No, that's my starter pack right there.
All right. Well, we'll expect, you know, a second pack and a third pack as you come along. So
okay, yeah, no doubt. I ain't going nowhere.
Good. So listen, switching gears. How did you first hear about our museum, the Museum of the American Military Family, and why do you think it's important that we're capturing the family experience?
Well, I first heard about it when I retired out the military the end of 2017. I was working for the Veterans Memorial, and they were talking. I remember I was trying to get into the VA, and they were talking about, oh, my friend Cersei works there, and she works for the Military Family Museum, our Military Family Museum. So I remember that sparked my interest, because I was like, it talks about the family, but it wasn't until I talked to you, Cersei, because I didn't know how to maneuver the VA. You got to remember, I grew up in the military, and then when I I grew up in the military and then joined the military, so I didn't know anything about insurance. I didn't know anything about learning what to do at the hospital. When we moved to different bases, you filled out your name and you were integrated into the hospital.
Right.
Well, this is a whole different world when I got out, so I needed your help. How did I get into the VA? What do they do? What can they do for me? And you were very helpful. And then I asked you about the Military Family Museum, and you just told me that, oh, it's about focusing on the family museum.
Mm-hmm.
When I went up there, I loved the exhibits. I loved the way the house, it was set up like a house, like a military house. So well, I think that is important because it is easily overlooked. We talk about the military veterans that go over there, don't understand, as I remember as a military family member, that we were just as much in the war as anybody else. Like when we saw Daddy go off to Kosovo, or when he went off to Desert Storm, like we were all waiting for him to come back. We hoped that, you know, he came back safely, and life changed as we knew it. So it's almost like we were deployed just as much. Like school went along, school went along fine. We did our extracurricular program, like sports and stuff like that, but we were missing an important part of our family. And we had to go on without that, and just without internet, we just had to deal with that.
Right.
So with this family museum, I believe it's important to tell the other side of the story, because we can thank the military member, but the family members are also deployed in their own way.
Right.
And it's just important to tell their story from the spouse all the way to the children. Everything has affected us. Everything has affected us at some point. And our stories are just as important as a military member, because without us, that military member couldn't function, and vice versa.
It's a relationship. You're right.
Absolutely.
So, you know, you volunteer a lot at the museum, and you talk to a lot of our visitors. What do visitors say when they come into the museum? What kind of reactions do they have?
A lot of business reactions, even from military family members on down to veterans and just random people. A lot of people are like, wow, this is some great stuff. I've never seen all this stuff before. A couple of people I've talked to, I didn't know that the family members went through just as much. I didn't know they had much of a story. Now, a lot of our exhibits there has a lot to do with, you know, there's a lot of, and it focuses more on just the veteran. But as we break it up and we send them through the different sections of the family member, the spouses, the children, and, you know, we got the different sections for the DOD schools that were all over the world, people start to understand, like, they just think that we're just sitting out there, just going somewhere and we come back home. People don't understand that there's a whole community going on all over the world that we do to keep, that we do in order to keep the service member into the fight. So a lot of people are surprised about that, that all that is going on, and that our life is so much of a, as the same contrast as the military member.
Yeah, I because, you know, you work on days that I'm not there and vice versa. Sometimes we overlap, but, you know, I know that you as a vet, you can relate to the veterans who come in, and because you're a brat, you can relate to the brats. I'm not a military brat, but I'm a DOD, you know, I grew up over in the DOD schools, and then I'm a spouse, so I have different experiences. So I know that the veterans, very often, you know, you can talk to them on veteran level, on brat level, you know, kind of.
I'm really the guy that's the cook. That's all around trick of the trade. I believe in that museum because it does speak to me every way. And then being a veteran, I can come in and talk to and relate to the veterans. And then the few people that come in that are brats, I can also say the same thing. And it really is a match made in heaven. I'm so glad I found the museum and I volunteered there, because the conversation I've had with people have been so rewarding.
And I know that one of the things that people tell me is they feel like they belong. They come in and they're immediately comfortable. They can sit down and we're not going to look at them like they're nuts when they start going off on a tangent, because we understand the, you know, the culture. So I think that's one of the things that I like most about it. And it's set up like a house. So we just sit on our living room couch and, you know, hang out.
Yeah, definitely. I think my most favorite part is seeing the ironing board with the uniform. Nowadays, yeah, you don't have to iron your uniforms anymore. They definitely modified that. But I remember back in the day, like, the family and me, and my mom would help iron the uniform because they had to be crisp and
exactly
and spotless and stiff, and then the shoes had to be fine. Sometimes I helped shine the shoes, but when I got in the military, I did.
So Art, I think I've lost you just now. Did you just fade away? Your cell phone signal just went.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you now, but you did fade. So we might need to wrap.
Oh wow! Okay, so no, what I'm.
So you're going again. So listen, I think at this point we probably need to wrap it up because it looks like it's storming out here, so that might be something. And so I wanted to thank you for being on our podcast. Can you hear me? So I wanted to thank you very much, Art, for being on this podcast and talking to us today. It's been a real pleasure. Our podcasts are supported in part by a New Mexico Arts, the New Mexico Humanities Council, Sandia Area Credit Union, as well as organizations such as Military Brats Registry and Military Brats Seal. And we've been talking to Art Harris. He's an Air Force veteran and Air Force brat, and also the operations officer for the museum. And I'm really sad I lost him, but I appreciate his being on for as long as he could be today. So thank you, Art.